From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
America's new president baffles the world. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. When it comes to foreign policy, the Trump administration is speaking with many voices. In Europe last weekend, Vice President Pence and Defense Secretary Mattis had different messages. Secretary of State Tillerson has said almost nothing at all. And nobody knows what President Trump knows, or whether he'll set the U.S. in new and different directions with unexpected tweets or unscripted comments. He's already had to replace one national security advisor with another as the administration veers between traditional positions and radical change. Later on today's Talking Point is the conservative movement taking on a new look. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Since World War II, the U.S. has dominated the West and claimed to champion liberal democracy in the rest of the world. But in the months since Donald Trump was inaugurated, American foreign policy has changed. Or has it? We'll look for answers today. Today's Talking Point, the Conservative Political Action Conference, gets underway today. We'll hear how it's changed since the days of Barry Goldwater, William F. Buckley, and Ronald Reagan. First is News Update. Refugees who come to the U.S. from Africa and the Middle East are trekking through the snow for asylum in Canada. Yesterday, Prime Minister Trudeau said the door will stay open even to people who cross illegally because Canadians trust their immigration system. But that doesn't mean there are no political problems. Andrea Hopkins is Ottawa Bureau Chief for Reuters. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us about the increase in refugees into Canada from the U.S.
Well, it really started with Trump's executive order. We started to see would-be refugees coming across the border. It's happening in Manitoba and in Quebec, borders with New York. Really, groups that have been living in the United States for a long time and aren't necessarily new claimants, but feel that their lot is better cast with Canada right now because of the dichotomy between Trump and Trudeau.
What are the original countries these people come from?
It's a range, and officials will say they expect it to continue to be fairly diverse. However, we're seeing a lot from Africa, from Somalia, Ghana, countries where there is already a community, particularly the Somalis in the U.S. Midwest, up near the border with Canada already. Those are some of the flows we're seeing. But we're also seeing Asians, we're seeing Tibetans, we're seeing, you know, a range of people from countries that might have once chosen the United States as their ultimate destination or their goal, but now looking beyond the United States to Canada. A lot of Muslim nations, those named in the executive order and those not named in the executive orders, who just see perhaps a friendlier welcome in Canada.
How many people are we talking about?
We're not talking about a lot. We're talking about hundreds so far, not thousands. So in the last month, there have been about 450 in Quebec, you know, dozens last week and on the Manitoba border. But this is much more than there have been in previous years. So it's really the increase that is a little bit jarring to Canadians. And these are border crossings that have never had a flow of people over. These are farmers' fields and small roads and townships. So it's not a regular thing, and it's really caught the attention of Canadians.
Why do they have to cross at those places, and what does it have to do with what's referred to as the Safe Third Country Agreement?
Right. So this is a legal agreement that the United States and Canada came to after 9/11, where we said both countries are welcoming to refugees. We recognize each other's country as a safe country. Therefore, if an asylum seeker shows up at our border from yours, we send them back and vice versa, because they already are at a safe country. So that means if they cross at a regular border crossing with a border guard and you please present your passport, that kind of thing, they will be turned away. It is a perverse disincentive, this agreement, that therefore sends them to irregular crossings, illegal crossings, farmers' fields, this vast undefended border between the two countries. They go there because as soon as they make landfall in Canada, they can make an asylum claim, and they don't have that right at a regular border crossing. So this safe third country agreement is in dispute right now, with some refugee advocates saying it should be suspended with the U.S. right now because the U.S. is not a safe country for refugees under Trump, some would argue, and so it should be suspended so that we are not sending these people to risk their lives in the snowy, you know, frontier, while other are saying, no, of course, the United States accepts refugees. They should be considered a safe country. And the Canadian government is so far standing by it, saying the terms of the treaty haven't changed. That's why we're getting them crossing illegally rather than at a regular border crossing.
It sounds as if the government is getting heat from both those who favor immigrants and those who don't.
Yes, and they're quite firm. Prime Minister Trudeau has been very welcoming. Diversity makes Canada stronger is his regular line. The Conservatives on the right side are just criticizing border security. Are we sure we're making enough checks with these people? Can we identify them? Are we, you know, is the border too porous? Do we have the resources to deal with this kind of thing? The Conservative Party in Canada tend to be pro-immigrant as well. So it's not quite as far right as in the United States right now. Whereas on the left, the New Democrats and refugee advocates, human rights advocates, are just saying this is dangerous to have the safe third country agreement in place because it risks the lives of, you know, families. And we've seen children crossing and that sort of thing, and frostbite, people losing their fingers, that kind of thing. So that's the concern on that side of the political spectrum.
So public sentiment is divided then. We'll see what happens as the number increases, if in fact it does. In the meantime, as you indicated, hundreds are trying to cross the border despite the hardships that they endure. Andrea Hopkins, Ottawa Bureau Chief for Reuters, thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, America's new president baffles the world on To the Point from Public Radio International.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Allen back with To the Point. As diplomats from some 50 countries met for the annual security conference in Munich last weekend, the main question was whether the U.S. has a coherent foreign policy. In advance, organizers even asked if President Trump sees international security as a game to be used whenever he needs domestic political distractions. As the conference continued, there were different messages from Vice President Pence and Defense Secretary Mattis. Ken Thomas was there for the Associated Press today. He's at the White House, where Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is meeting with the president. Good to have you on our program, Ken Thomas.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Good, thank you. We'll catch up on the meeting today. But in the first instance, tell us, if you will, about these different messages from the vice president and the Secretary of Defense.
Well, Mike Pence went to Munich and Brussels over the weekend. It was a visit aimed at reassuring NATO partners and Europe. And by all accounts, he was well received. He said that the U.S., you know, would show unwavering support for NATO, would hold Russia accountable on the violence in eastern Ukraine. But I think the key takeaway was that there seemed to be some questions among the diplomatic corps in Munich on whether Pence actually speaks on Trump's behalf. And there was a sense that Trump could simply override these statements in 140 characters or less on Twitter. So what we're seeing now, I think, is the Secretary of State Tillerson and Secretary Kelly are going to be going to Mexico City later today. They'll be meeting tomorrow. And, you know, that's another example where the administration is going to try to reassure a key partner that you know, there's some unity, even though there's been a rocky start. I mean, obviously, Enrique Peña Nieto canceled his visit to the U.S. Over this dust up over the border wall and who will pay for it. Tillerson and Kelly will be arriving in Mexico City shortly after, some more details came out from the administration on immigration. They'll have to explain some of those policies. So it's a case that we're seeing where other members of the administration are trying to reassure partners, but there's some questions about whether they fully speak for the president and whether the president may go rogue, so to speak.
Back to Munich, the Secretary of Defense was there. Did he have anything to say about NATO? Did he talk about what the president has said in terms of other countries having to pay their fair share?
Right. Mattis has made the case that NATO partners need to, pay more on defense. The goal that NATO has laid out is 2% of GDP. And, you know, it's an argument that some leaders within NATO have been making in recent years. That's in line with what President Trump has been asking for as well. And Mattis was also, someone who sought to reassure partners on the U.S. commitment to NATO. I think the question on the defense funding is whether that raises any concerns that NATO and the commitments may be transactional. That would there be consequences to NATO partners if they didn't reach that 2% of GDP expenditures on defense? Would there possibly be ramifications for that? And that was a question that Pence got in his news conference with the Secretary General of NATO. And I don't think there was a real clear answer there in terms of what would happen to some of these partners if they did not reach that 2% goal.
Ken Thomas, again, White House reporter for the Associated Press, just back from Munich and now waiting for the Secretary of State and the president to finish their meeting. Robin Wright is with us. She writes for The New Yorker magazine. She's a joint fellow at the Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center. She's written extensively quite recently in The New Yorker about the foreign policy of the new administration. Good to have you back on our program. Can you hear me, Robin Wright?
Always great to be
there
with you.
There you are. Warren. Okay. Tell us, if you will, does it appear that this is a major change, as some people have said, or that there will be a major change after about 25 years of American policy?
Well, I think on many fronts that's the case. You take a look at the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the president has said that he's willing to accept either a one-state or a two-state or whatever the two sides agree on. You had a bit of a sense that there's not a great definition to that issue yet, but there may be a wider array of solutions, as the president's seen it, than the last three presidents have. On Russia, he is talking about trying to better relations with Vladimir Putin, and that's certainly a change from the suspicion, the skepticism about Russia demonstrated by many presidents, dating back to the Cold War, but even after it. I think on many fronts, there is a sense that this president is charting a different course that may be a real break from foreign policy. The bottom line, however, is that the administration has been so all over the map so far that a lot is really uncertain, and that has been even more unnerving for many of our allies.
So it's all over the map because we're getting different messages from different people. From the Secretary of State, we apparently aren't getting any message at all. What do you draw from that? What conclusion do you draw from that? He hasn't had much to say.
No, and I've covered every Secretary of State since Henry Kissinger, and I have never seen anyone come into this position being so low-key, being so unstaffed. There are no senior appointments anywhere at the State Department, his undersecretary, his assistant secretary, deputy secretary, and that leaves him slightly vulnerable. I'm not sure he would have run ExxonMobil, where he was president for many years, the way that he's running the State Department. They don't have the staff, and if there's any kind of crisis, I don't think either the State Department or the NSC, which is only now getting its new chief advisor and may actually see some staffing changes. I don't think either one of them is ready for a major crisis right now.
With regard to this issue of staffing at the State Department, a lot of people, of course, who were with the Obama administration have quit. Sean Spicer, the White House spokesman, was asked about that today and whether the president is micromanaging the State Department.
We want to make sure that the people who staff a Trump administration are committed to a Trump agenda. And that's, so cabinet secretaries and other administrators and directors have broad discretion. But I think at the end of the day, no matter what position you have, whether it's the lowest or the highest in the White House or in a department or agency, we should be making sure that people who are coming in as appointees of the president support the president's agenda.
Robin Wright, you said you go back to the Secretary of Stateship of Henry Kissinger. Have other Secretaries of State been limited in that way by presidents?
Well, I'm sure every president wants people who are loyalist to them, but there is a sense that Rex Tillerson was not allowed to pick even his deputy. He had selected Elliot Abrams as his number two, and the president apparently decided because of Elliot Abrams' criticism of him during the campaign that he didn't want him in that job, even though he's appointed Ben Carson and Rick Perry, who were two rivals who didn't always have nice things to say about him during the presidential campaign. So it's a little peculiar, but yes, I think that being this deep into an administration, even though it's a month, and not to have these key appointment sounds like he is wants to have the last word on all the major appointments.
Let me go back to Ken Thomas, a White House reporter for the Associated Press. Spicer was asked today if, in fact, Secretary of State Tillerson and Secretary of Homeland Security Kelly, when they go to Mexico, will be doing a sort of cleanup operation. What's the genesis of that question, and how did Spicer respond?
Well, he, one of the rocky starts of the administration was the Mexico visit. Enrique Peña Nieto was supposed to visit the U.S. Typically, the U.S. and Mexican leaders get together at the start of the administration because of the neighbor relationship, and that didn't happen. The border wall and President Trump's calls for the Mexican government to pay for it did not sit very well in Mexico, and so that visit was called off. And so, so Tillerson and Kelly are now, going to be going to Mexico City. Sean did push aside the notion that it's a cleanup operation. He said that, right now there's a very healthy and robust relationship and called the relationship phenomenal. But, it's clear that there are some major issues, major disputes between the U.S. and Mexican governments right now, related to immigration, related to the border wall, related to some of the policies. There's some concerns in Mexico that, there could be, somewhat like refugee camps in the northern part of the country along the border if there's a real push to remove. Move people living here illegally from the U.S.
Okay, a lot for them to talk about when they get to Mexico. We'll have to find out what happens when they do. Ken Thomas, again, waiting for them to come out of the meeting with the president. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Michael Auslan is with us. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also a columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
We're hearing from Robin Wright, from Ken Thomas, from many others as well, that the administration, the Europeans were saying the same thing after the visits of the vice president and the secretary of defense last weekend, that the administration is speaking with different voices about foreign policy. You've written that you see a logic to all of this. What is it?
Well, I think first, Warren, we have to distinguish between attitudes and policies. I think much of what the people that were looking at the early days of the Trump administration were worried about was the attitude. Would they even engage with the world? Were they simply going to withdraw and that it was going to be all American first? And I think what we're seeing is that the attitude is pretty much what we expect from presidents. They're making mistakes, but they're trying to rectify it, such as the trip down to Mexico City today. After questioning the utility of alliances, they send off the vice president and the secretary of defense to Munich. So the attitude is that we are still going to engage with the world. The question remains on the policies. The piece that I wrote, I think, is that there is a logic to what the administration is doing in the very broad sense of the picture, which is that issues that the president believes really are domestic, such as free trade or border control, he is going to follow the more radical policies that he laid out or the radical worldview that he laid out during the campaign. So withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, renegotiate NAFTA, institute a travel ban. On the other hand, those policies which really are foreign, question of alliances or the question of the one China policy, for example, he seems so far at least to be willing to uphold the status quo. And that's what all the messages coming from the very top from him and from the secretaries have been.
Michael Laughlin again at the American Enterprise Institute. Back to Robin Wright at the New Yorker and the Institute for Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center. Do you agree with this distinction between attitude and policy?
Well, not yet. Look, We've seen some very tough language from the president, for example, about the future of NATO and the future of the European Union. He said Brexit was a good thing and there might be even be other countries who leave the European Union, almost as if he was encouraging them. On NATO, he's said, it's obsolete. You know, it's not viable for what our interests are. So, you know, then you get the Secretary of Defense going to a NATO meeting and saying, well, we believe in NATO. And then you see the Vice President going to Europe and saying, we want to be Europe's allies. So there is this fundamental contradiction that leaves us all baffled about exactly what's happening, what his goals are. And at the end of the day, Trump has repeatedly made it clear that he has the last word on everything. And you wonder to some degree if there isn't already within the administration an emerging gap over ultimate goals, how much you try to move slowly, gradually to implement policies, or versus what the president seems to be racing into, a lot of big decisions very quickly without a lot of negotiation. And sometimes, even indications that he may not be getting the daily intelligence report, which worries a lot of people. He does things in a very unconventional way. And as a lot of presidents have learned, you have to pay attention to traditional conventions you have to be a player. You have to collaborate or engage rather than try to dictate if you want to be effective.
Michael Laughlin, we just have about 15 seconds until we go to our break, but very quickly, and I'll let you elaborate when we come back after the break. Do you think there's a gap in the White House and a lot of uncertainty and a kind of internal war going on?
I don't know if there's an internal war. I think every administration has a rough shakedown period. President Obama lost his national security advisor a year in and his director of national intelligence. We've never had a tweeter in chief. There's no question that this introduces an uncertain element. On the other hand, I think there is much more stay the course. He's reaffirmed the alliances with Korea and Japan. He's committed to supporting the Senkakus. He has talked about China as well.
All right. Once again, now we're going to take a very brief break. We will come right back and continue this conversation. On our talking point later is the conservative movement taking on a new look. We'll talk about that back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. Warren Onlybeck with To the Point, once again talking about foreign policy and the new administration, the Trump administration. To what extent is it devoted toward radical change? To what extent is it devoted to continuing traditional policies? And what about the fact that we have now a tweeter-in-chief who might, in fact, change anything at any time? One thing that has been very public, of course, has been the change in the national security advisor. Dan DeLuce is with us. He's chief national security correspondent for Foreign Policy Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We now have General McMaster having replaced General Flynn. What's the difference?
I think there's a pretty big, difference because McMaster is not coming from a military intelligence background. He's coming from a combat operations background, and then he's also an accomplished historian in his own right. The book he wrote about the Vietnam War is a kind of a classic. So you have someone who is much less ready to pull the trigger. He's a pretty sober-minded personality.
Wasn't his classic book, though, designed to suggest to the military that they ought not necessarily take the orders of the civilians who are supposed to be in control?
That's right. He took to task the Joint Chiefs during the Vietnam War in his book, and he basically condemned them. He called them the five silent men because he said they basically were weak and spineless and didn't tell the president what he didn't want to hear. And so I think it's pretty interesting, given the book he wrote about standing up and speaking uncomfortable truths, that now he's going to be in a very interesting White House with a very politically minded president with no experience in foreign policy, already reportedly a very chaotic decision-making process in place. And McMaster is someone who has told his own superiors bad news and things they didn't want to hear. And so now he's going to have to live up to what he wrote about.
And isn't President Trump demonstrably somebody who doesn't want to hear bad news?
I think there are some indications of that. There are indications, too, that he's not a person who reads, and he has a pretty short attention span from all accounts. And so he's also someone who likes to go and get his own information and sort of resists a kind of centralized, deliberate process. So one thing that even Flynn was fighting against was trying to impose some kind of orderly decision-making deliberation. And McMaster wrote about how LBJ and Kennedy also sort of resisted an orderly process and would rely on a very narrow circle of people, and political considerations tended to weigh heavily on those discussions. And so General McMaster has a very uphill struggle here, right? He's got to try to impose a process, and he's also got to build a rapport with the president. He's got to break through the inner circle that stood with Trump during the campaign. He's an outsider, dominated right now by political aides and ideologues.
Michael Osland, again, let me go back to Michael Osland, I should say, at the American Enterprise Institute, columnist with the Wall Street Journal. Also, I should mention, author of a book called The End of the Asian Century, just out. Are you reassured by General McMaster getting this job, or are you also paying attention to the fact that Donald Trump might not be the kind of person who wants to hear things who wants criticism? Let's put it that way.
Well, the proof will be in the pudding, obviously. Like everyone who knows General McMaster, and I know him slightly, he's an extraordinary thinker. He's an incredibly honest person, and you can't think of anyone better to have. Now, you know, the question of him being appointed, certainly for a president who knows what a potential deputy secretary of state said about him during the campaign, he has to know what General McMaster said about the civilian-military relations in the Vietnam War. He appointed someone who clearly has different views on the relationship than what we tend to think Donald Trump expects from people, which is sort of yes men. It's the same thing with General Mattis, and it's the same thing with Tillerson. I think we want to have that type of debate within the administration. I think you want strong personalities. You don't want a bunch of yes men and ideologues. If there are different voices coming, that to me is a very good thing. Ultimately, however, it has to result in a clear and coherent policy. And what we've been talking about, Warren, I think to say that you know, the president may not be following something along the lines of the prior understandings of where we go with Middle East peace or the like. Look, every president gets to put their stamp on foreign policy. The question that I think people were most worried about, again, was that attitude. Did he even care about the world? Would he even engage and listen? Right now, I think the answer is yes, but they're going to have to come up with clear and consistent policy and make sure that it's not chaotic when they try to implement it.
Are you sure the president knows what he's getting into with General McMaster? I've seen reports that he'd never heard of him until very recently, and he's not a big reader, so it may not be likely that he's read the book that criticized the Joint Chiefs of Staff for letting themselves be pushed around by civilians in the past.
Well, I'm assuming his staff knew that because they very thoroughly vetted and checked everyone who signed letters or made statements during the campaign. Don't think it's a surprise that the president doesn't know him. I don't think that if you haven't been doing that job in foreign policy or national security, you'd know really any of those people. So, again, the question is, and I think this is the same question that we get to with Secretaries Mattis and Tillerson, and this is a point that Robin brought up that's very important. How does the staffing go? When will you get the deputies in and the people who actually run and make the policy? If we don't start seeing that soon, then I think there's a lot to worry about. Right now, the fact that there's different voices, I think that actually may be a sign of strength rather than a weakness.
Let me go back to Robin Wright with The New Yorker and the Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center. What about the question of staffing? And will General McMaster be able, do you think, apparently unlike the Secretary of State, we don't know yet about General Mattis at Defense, but will McMaster be able to create his own staff? Apparently a lot of people already put in place by General Flynn before he left.
Well, that's the key point. And if they were starting with a fresh slate, I think we'd have a very different group of people at the National Security Council. The fact is that Mike Flynn has resigned and left, but he has left behind the staff who reflect his thinking, his preferences on policy, his attitude toward crisis spots in place. And it's very heavily staffed with military personnel and people from the Defense Intelligence Agency. The White House claims that that McMaster will have the right to bring in his own staff. But, for example, he has a deputy already in place, a woman who is a commentator on Fox News. And one of the biggest questions is, will she stay or not? There's also something that's happened in the month since he took office, and that is that Steve Bannon, his chief strategist, has consolidated power. And particularly with the resignation of General Flynn, he has come out in many ways ahead. He is the chief broker. He is the chief ear, the overseer of what happens. Before, there was probably more balance between the NSC advisor and the chief strategist. Now I think that Bannon comes out ahead, as does the family. Jared Kushner, I think, is ever more important in the president's thinking. So you have the kind of ideologues and family who have, I think, at this juncture, a real edge over McMaster and those coming in. Now, I think down over the long term, McMaster may be able to exert himself, but it depends a lot on whether he has to constantly fight battles among staff trying to balance out opinion or whether he can really focus on process with a lot of support from people he trusts.
Dan DeLuce, back to you with the Foreign Policy Magazine. With all that we've heard about Bannon, about his nationalistic orientation, about his relationship to the alt-right, his former ownership or operationalship of the Breitbart News organization, does he concern you? And do you think that he's going to be able to prevail over General McMaster, or is this a battle we're going to have to watch?
I think we're going to have to watch it, but Robin's right. McMaster comes in at a disadvantage because Stephen Bannon was at Trump's side during the election when things looked pretty difficult, even bleak at moments, and they won the election. And so Trump trusts Bannon for that reason, and of course his son-in-law. So, McMaster has to build a relationship. If he doesn't have a direct line, if he doesn't have FaceTime with the president, it's kind of game over, really. And we've seen that in previous White Houses. You know, Obama's first national security advisor, General Jones, the retired Marine general, he couldn't really break through the inner circle in Obama's White House. So that's the first challenge. But there's also this issue that we keep touching on, which is this lack of overarching vision or policy. And that's something McMaster will also have to try to construct and create and help impose. And that's a very big question mark because the president is so transactional in the way he seems to approach issues.
By transactional, you've used that message, that word before, rather. What do you mean transactional in the context of foreign policy?
Well, the U.S. And most countries, don't, at least Western countries, tend not to look at everything on a zero-sum basis as a one-off deal. So you don't look at your alliance with Japan and ask yourself, what are we getting out of it today? Was it worth the X amount of money that we've put into this base in Okinawa? It's supposed to be a much longer-term strategic way of thinking, where you look at the network of your alliances and you ask yourself what U.S. interests are and what best serves U.S. interests. So it's not about short-term bargains about this particular trade agreement or that particular military base or weapon system. It's about protecting U.S. interests and values. And it's not just a matter of money, and it's not just a real estate deal. And I think he tends to talk about foreign policy and what people use this word transactional, because everything seems to be kind of a deal, a singular, discrete deal, instead of sort of an interlocking vision of what you see U.S. interests are and how to pursue those.
Michael Auslan, back to you with the Wall Street Journal. We heard earlier about the 2% of GDP that all members of NATO are supposed to pay, and the fact that the president has said that he doesn't think everybody's paying it, and it's perfectly obvious that everybody isn't. Do you think that that might cause a problem, even though the vice president, Mr. Pence, did say that the president is still committed to NATO? Might he, on a transactional basis, say, wait a minute, we're not getting enough out of this, it's costing us too much, and consequently, we're not going to, for example, invoke Article 5 if one of the other countries is attacked?
Well, I think there's very little likelihood that the U.S. is going to walk away from NATO again. I think the signals coming from both the vice president and the Secretary of Defense have assuaged those fears. Now, Secretary Mattis did say that if the NATO nations, all of them, don't step up to pay the 2%, that the United States may consider moderating its commitment. But that is something that the Trump administration inherits, that frustration from the Obama administration, where they made the same complaint. They're just trying to squeeze the screws a little bit tighter. I would say just very quickly, if I can, on Dan's interesting point on the transactional issues. You know, when you talk to our allies, particularly in Asia, there was a great frustration with what they considered to be the ambiguity of the Obama administration. It was never quite clear where the rhetoric met some of the reality in the South China Sea or the Korean Peninsula or the like. And so I think there is at least the potential. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a certainty, but there's the potential that at some level a transactional approach can have a clarity that allies prefer. It is a different way of doing business. There's no question about it. It should take into account interests. But if you are simply talking at these sort of vague generalities about values but not doing anything to affect the trends that are most worrisome to these nations, I think in some ways they would rather have that transaction. And you may have seen some of it with the Japanese premier's visit the other week, where they got directly from the president a commitment to protect the Senkakus under the terms of the treaty, and the Japanese also made clear that they were willing to invest in America. It is different, but there may be elements to it that would add some stability to relations that have actually been uncertain for the past couple of years.
Let me go quickly back to Robin Wright at The New Yorker. What about this question of being transactional as the president surrounds himself with so many generals, particularly now, of course, the National Security Advisor, General McMasters? Are they transactional types, they and the Secretary of Defense and the, I don't know about the general who's running the Department of Homeland Security, but we're talking about foreign policy. Is that something that military people are comfortable with? Are you comfortable? Should we all be comfortable with the idea that the president, who is, of course, the leading civilian authority, is surrounding himself with so many military people?
Well, the bottom line is that there are very few people in this administration who have ever made any type of policy. The military is not behind policy. It enacts military decisions. The ideologues, many of them have had no government experience, and the thing that concerns me the most is that you have a group of neophytes, whether it's at when it comes to policymaking, when it comes to, for example, the Secretary of State. John Kelly at Homeland Security may be a very good military man. He gets good marks. But the fact is he has never had to make these complicated policy decisions that often today in a globalizing world involve dealing with allies, not just a complicated array of personalities and opinions in Washington, but globally. And remember, we're acting as if the United States is the one that makes these decisions for everyone else in the world, that it's when it comes to NATO, it's us that decides what everybody has to pay or where everybody should be deployed. Remember that there are, with this kind of fraying of alliances, international alliances, that it may be that some countries are not so eager to go with us, whether it's in a coalition of the willing in Iraq or deploying in a place like NATO or in Afghanistan, where NATO made its first deployment outside Europe since it was created, that there is a lot going on here. Angela Merkel, who's now the voice of Western liberal democracies because since the election here, has said, look, no country can solve problems alone. The question is this administration really willing to engage in collaborative ways, as it's shown already in a place like Mexico? You know, it wants to be confrontational with a country that is tremendously important to our economy and to our security.
Very quickly, Michael Osland, last question to you. This is all the time we have. How do you respond to that, and are you concerned about what might be next?
I think there's always a question when there's a lack of consistency on the part of the United States. I think our allies were more worried during the campaign when there were far more radical suggestions being put out there about where the United States would go under potential President Trump. I think they're going to do what they do with all presidents, which is give them some time to get a team in place to come up with the policies. If they don't see that, if they're worried about it, then we will have trouble sustaining our alliances and sustaining our partnerships. But again, I think a robust debate over what the United States will be doing is important. It's not the question. I think they've been pretty clear that they're going to simply be America first and up go the drawbridges. But they're going to have to come up with really hard questions about how to deal with North Korea, the South China Sea, Russia, and Iran, just to start off with.
All right. Michael Osland again at the American Enterprise Institute, Wall Street Journal, his book, The End of the Asian Century. Robin Wright, writing for The New Yorker, and also at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center. Dan DeLuce, Chief National Security Correspondent for Foreign Policy Magazine, and our earlier guest, Ken Thomas, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Many thanks to you all. Is infotainment trumping conservative discourse at this year's Political Action Conference? Back in a moment with that idea on today's Talking Point. Warren Allna here with today's Talking Point. The Conservative Political Action Conference dates back to the 1960s, when it started out as a fringe movement trying to influence the Republican Party. It became America's largest annual gathering of right-wing intellectuals with the capacity to draw some 10,000 people. As it begins this year's session today, it's showing how much the conservative movement has been influenced by Donald Trump and by political theater. Mona Charman is a syndicated columnist, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Institute. Good to have you back on our program. Welcome.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be with you.
A lot of publicity for the conference that they probably didn't want after having to disinvite Milo Yiannopoulos, who subsequently resigned as an editor at Breitbart because of what it appeared he had ultimately said about pedophilia some time ago.
Oh, so it turns out that somebody somewhere has a standard. Look, this was a terrible failure on the part of the organizers of CPAC. You know, Donald Trump has occupied the Republican Party, but CPAC stands for Conservative Political Action Conference. It is not a creature of the Republican Party. It was supposed to be about conservatism, and conservatism used to be about more than being infotainment or provocateur or making the correct people angry. It used to be about a set of ideas, and it used to be about a seemliness. Conservatism was a cultural as much as a political phenomenon. It stressed the importance of tradition, morals, modesty, manners. All of those things now seem like faint memories in the rush to get clicks, to get headlines, and to, as I say, to be a provocateur and get people angry, get the right people angry at you.
Has CPAC then ceased to be a source of intellectual ferment and policy ideas and the kind of things that you're talking about from a cultural standpoint?
Well, they have withdrawn the invitation to Milo. Now they have an opportunity to rebuild, but there is just no question that there's a lot of rebuilding that needs to be done. Look, I'm the kind of person who thinks that it's really exciting and thrilling to listen to a speech by Mitch Daniels. Maybe I don't speak for very many people, but I think the sorry about the dog barking in the background.
That's all right.
I think that the organizers of this conference are going to have to rethink in light of what happened, in light of the scandal that they have created for themselves with Milo.
We'll assume that's not a political argument coming from the other part of the art of the room. Donald Trump himself is a bit of a provocateur, to say the least.
Yes, he surely is, and that's why I mentioned at the beginning that Donald Trump has been able to colonize the Republican Party, and at least in part, it is because the infotainment wing of the conservative movement let its standards drop so markedly. There were a great many people in talk radio and on Fox News, not all of them on Fox News, but significant numbers, who went for ratings. They found that Trump was good for ratings, and so even though he was nobody's idea of a conservative, they jumped on the train. And we will see. It is certainly the Conservative Political Action Conference used to be about conservatism, and if Milo is their idea of what conservatism has become, then it's bankrupt.
Well, Milo is gone because of the problems that I mentioned earlier, at least from the conference. What about people like Ann Coulter, who's, of course, also been very provocative? She's one of the speakers as well.
Yeah, and she should be ridden out of town on a rail, too. I mean, she's a most despicable person, a public persona, I should say. I don't mean this personally about her, but the things that she has said.
Thank you. We obviously don't have her to respond to your concerns.
Right. No, but the public statements that she has made have been highly offensive, and again, just aimed to enrage. We live in the era of the troll, the person who sets out simply to say things that that inflame the other side. And there's, we see this on both sides of the divide. We see it among liberals, and we see it among conservatives. I feel very strongly that just because liberals have done it to conservatives is not an excuse for conservatives to stoop to the same methods, and that for both for the sake of our civil society, we really need to step back from the brink here and try to remember that we are not enemies but friends, to quote Lincoln. This is February, and to remember that for our side, that conservatism should be about values that are much more important, that have more content than simply simply making the other side angry.
Point out to our listeners, you were no fan of Donald Trump, but what about CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference? It's been so important in the past with such large crowds, 10,000 people. That's enormous for a meeting of this kind. Do you think it ceased to be serving its function?
Well, it can serve that function again, but it will depend upon the organizers to become serious again and to recognize that. Look, okay, Donald Trump, you're right. I didn't support him, and I'm still a critic, though I will praise him when he does good things. But he does represent his presidency represents a challenge and an opportunity. The opportunity is to move him more in a conservative direction, policy-wise. And in order to do that, CPAC could play a very constructive role if they had people giving talks and panels and so forth that are about conservative policy ideas. I mean, Trump is quite innocent of all of this stuff. Really, he hasn't thought much about most public policy issues, and here's a chance to possibly move him in the direction that the conservative movement would most like to see on any number of important
very questions. Quickly, let me ask you a question about the conference itself. You mentioned Mitch Daniels. He, of course, a former governor of Indiana. And once you've had entertainers, if you will, or entertaining speakers of the kind that you mentioned, you're not going to be able to draw a crowd with Mitch Daniels, are you?
Well, let's hope that there is a let's hope that there is an equal and opposite reaction to all of this infotainment. Maybe people will have a longing for substance and for seriousness, seeing how clownish the thing has become.
Are you going to go at all?
No.
So, okay.
I have no plans to be
there. That pretty well tells the story. So you won't be able to come back and critique the conference then on a detailed basis.
I'm sorry. I would go, except that I'm on a book deadline. So.
Well, that's a good excuse, and we're glad you found the time to talk with us. Are you worried, though, just generally about the conservative movement?
Very worried. Yes, indeed. Look, I mean, you cannot have seen the election of a non-conservative, and many elected conservatives and conservative public figures and conservative opinion leaders, stepping in line to a new kind of philosophy, which is more nationalist than conservative, and not be dismayed. So, yes, I am worried.
Okay, we'll have to leave it at that. Mona Charon, again, syndicated columnist, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Institute. Thanks, as always.
My pleasure.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.